This is the BBC.
The surest sign that a deal seems to be close, or at least people who don't like the sound of that Brexit deal think it's close, is that the rhetoric becomes more blood-curdling, the warnings more stark, the nerves more obvious. And so it was this week when David Davis wrote to all Tory MPs to warn them of the dire electoral consequences of pushing on with the Prime Minister's Chequers plan. And International Development Secretary Penny Mordaunt found herself asked the same question again and again and again.
I think that we need to let the Prime Minister and her negotiating team get on with it. I'm supporting her in doing that. Well, the Prime Minister can count on my support, but what I would say is that we don't know where this is going to end up.
As the old saying goes, with friends like that, who needs the DUP as the people propping you up in government? This week, Arlene Foster, their leader, was in Brussels. But the message she had, at least in public, was for the Tories at home. Don't take our support for granted.
I am a unionist. I believe in the union of the United Kingdom. But what happens in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? We do not want Northern Ireland going off in a different direction from the rest of the UK. And that, to me, is fundamental.
The DUP do a nice line in tough rhetoric. The other day, telling the Today programme that their red lines were blood red. And one source telling a newspaper that the reason they wouldn't blink in the forthcoming negotiations was, and I quote, because they cut off their eyelids. Boris, of course, doesn't want to be left out of all this, so he tweeted, so much safer than an interview or a news conference, he tweeted that the Prime Minister's backstop for Northern Ireland would turn Britain into a permanent EU colony. But it was not a Brexiteer, but a Remainer, Ken Clark, the father of the House, who had a message for the Prime Minister. Don't worry about all of them. Get the support from people like me.
Does she equally accept that the maths makes it obvious that that majority can only be obtained if the agreement retains the support of the pro-European Conservative backbenchers in this House and also wins the support of a significant number of Labour backbenchers, pro-European backbenchers, on the other side of the House, which would reveal that the hardline Eurosceptic views of the Bennites on the Labour front bench and the right-wing nationalists in our party are a minority in this Parliament. Will she therefore proceed courageously on that basis in the formidable task that lies ahead of her?
There was a wry smile from Theresa May in response to that. She certainly wasn't going to dare to agree. Someone who probably would is my guest on the podcast this week. Ken Clark's old boss, the former Prime Minister, the veteran of European battles for 30 years, Sir John Major. Welcome to the Political Thinking Podcast. Thank you for doing it.
Thank you.
There is a phrase that I associate with you. A nation at ease with itself. It must feel now, as you see the bitter divisions in politics, like a distant dream, doesn't it?
Well, it does, rather. I mean, that was my ambition when I went into Downing Street. It wasn't easy to deliver in the midst of a recession with 14% interest rates and 10% inflation. And so I failed with many of the things I would have liked to have done to bring that closer together. But I don't think in the years that I have been involved in politics that I've ever seen quite such divisions on policy, particularly over Brexit, as we have at the present time. And I think the way in which some of the debate is conducted, not least because of the impact of social media, is a good deal less attractive than anything I've seen in the past. I think people seem to have lost track of the fact that people who disagree with you are opponents, they're not enemies. And there is a clear distinction between that.
When you were campaigning to be Prime Minister, when you were Prime Minister, you often recalled your days on that soapbox in Brixton, in South London. Mm. Did it feel very different? Wasn't there an aggression there of people sort of heckling and booing and telling you to shut up?
Well, no, there wasn't. I mean, my soapbox was most typically set up in Brixton Market, and I was a kid, 15, 16, 17, 18. And the thing that struck me most was was the extraordinary tolerance of the people who passed by listening to me booming through my microphone, occasionally listening, occasionally stopping, occasionally asking questions, but no one telling me to move on. No one telling me I knew nothing about everything and I should go away, learn about something and come back in 10 years' time. There was a degree of tolerance that was quite extraordinary. And that tolerance was in Brixton at a time of massive West Indian migration into Brixton, where there was a lot of social tension. And I think I learned a lot. It wasn't apparent to me until later, but I think I learned a lot about the essential tolerance of the people in this country to views that they may not necessarily agree with. And I think it is that tolerance that we're in danger of losing, and it will be a very precious thing to have lost if it goes.
You went further in a recent lecture that you did. You talked about the distaste for democracy, running deep distaste. And you said this was a global phenomenon and there was a danger to democracy. Do you think people are forgetting its values, maybe never learned the values of listening to others and of reaching agreement through either consensus or compromise?
I think there is a risk. We have been taught, and we began to be taught in the 80s and beyond, that compromise was weak, that people who walked in the middle of the road got knocked over. Now, I take the precise reverse view. I think if you can reach compromise, then that is an attractive thing to do, and I think wherever possible, it's a very wise thing to do. The Conservative Party that I care about, the Conservative Party I joined in 1959, was a practical party, a pragmatic party, a moderate party, and an international party. There was no concept of English nationalism or England first or whatever it may be in that party. They looked outward. And they looked at policy to see how it would practically affect people. Sometimes they may have got it wrong, but that was the way they looked at policy. That was what attracted me to the Conservative Party. And that is the way I think we should do so now.
You think instead that it's become an ideological party?
Well, not entirely, no. I think there is an ideological wing to the Conservative Party. The vast majority of the Conservative Party, and by that I don't just mean the parliamentary party, I mean the members who run the Rotary Club and the Women's Institute and local charities and who vote Conservatives, but may not actually be members, the Conservative voters. I think they are predominantly still moderate, centre-right, but moderate. But I think there is an ideological tinge that has grown up on the right wing of our party, which looks at the ideology first rather than the practical effect of policies upon people first. I think that's one of the problems that we have with the present debate over the European Union.
Now, let's go back, because we'll pursue your thoughts on Brexit in a second. Go back to this warning you gave about the danger to democracy. Does it come from the fact, in your view, that people look at a President Xi, you travel to China a lot, they look at a Putin, maybe now look at President Trump, you're just back from the United States, and think, well, he gets things done. That's what I like about it. There's no waffle, says what he means what he says, gets things done. Okay, it's a bit crude. Okay, there is not the freedom we might have hoped for. But that, these days, is not so important to us.
I think there's a lot in that. I mean, the first thing to say is that there's been UN reports showing that the quantity of civil liberties have fallen dramatically in a large number of countries and improved in a much smaller number of countries. So for the first time in my political life, democracy is on the defensive. And it's in part on the defensive, I think, because of what happened in 2007, 2008, with the financial crash that occurred. In every decade for the last 70 years, democracy and the free market had broadly improved people's living standards by about 20% a decade. They've also lifted literally billions of people out of absolute poverty. Since 2007, there hasn't been a 20% increase in well-being for the British people or the Europeans or the Americans. It's about 1%, and that 1% is only there because there's been a greater increase for people at the top of the salary level rather than at the bottom. And so people are saying, is this working for me? Are people doing the right thing? And they look, as you say, at the autocrats, at President Xi, at Putin perhaps, so perhaps Putin less at this particular moment, at other countries, and they say they can do things speedily. And the point is that autocracy isn't bothered with democracy. It doesn't have to consult. It doesn't have to persuade. It just does. And to many people, that seems economically attractive. What they forget with democracy is democracy actually reflects what people need and people wish. Autocracy does not. Autocracy can be brutal. There are people in gulags and prisons being shot in the back of the head in autocracies in a way that democracies would never tolerate because of the way in which we conduct our criminal justice system.
But people in the West, people who, like you, believe in capitalism, you have to find a way, capitalism has to find a way to deliver in a way that it is maybe not for more than a decade now. Is that your
that
view?
Is my...
And is it government's job, as it were, politicians' job, to make capitalism do it, to make business do what it's not doing on its own?
I think government have a role in that. I think the problem with capitalism is not that capitalism has failed. I mentioned a moment ago exactly what its record has been over a very long time. It is that events over the last 10 years have prevented it delivering what it did before. And we don't so much need to reform capitalism as to remove the abuses that have crept into capitalism. And it is those abuses that so offend people. I mean, I fully understand why this happened, but I absolutely understand why people were so angry about it. After the financial crash in 2007, central banks and governments had no choice but to bail out the banks and others, because otherwise our whole economic system would have collapsed. So they bailed out the people who were a part of creating the problem. And they didn't, of course, and couldn't, because they hadn't got the money, bail out the people who were hurt by the financial crash. And to the voter looking in, to the citizen looking in, the government is rushing to the aid of the people who created the problem and ignoring the people who suffered from their failure to prevent the problem. And that not only looked unfair, of course, it was unfair. And I think that did a great deal of damage. Now, this isn't going to be repaired, I think, until such time as we are back in a proper growth pattern, until we have a proper interest rate structure. So elderly people saving at last get some reward for their life savings when they deposit it yet again. And it isn't going to improve until workers, often at the bottom of the heap, begin to see salary increases that actually improve their living standards year on year.
Some think, though, that before any Conservative government gets the chance to do that, Jeremy Corbyn might get in, because as Jim O'Neill, a financier, former minister in the Treasury, joined the Tories, or at least joined a Tory government, has recently said, Corbyn's identifying the problem. He might not always have the right solution, but he is identifying the right problems. Is there something in that, that Jeremy Corbyn has spotted what the problems are with capitalism, even though I imagine you disagree with pretty much everything he stands for?
I've looked very carefully at what Jeremy Corbyn has to say. And I have no doubt he believes what he says, and let me make that point absolutely clear. But he is, it seems to me, a practicing Marxist, which is very alien to the way in which we run affairs in our own country. Now, within what he says, he has identified some problems that I feel as strongly about as he does, and so do millions of Tories. And the Conservative Party shouldn't turn its back on the problems they can perceive that Mr. Corbyn has identified simply because he has identified them. And they have to deal with them. It is, for example, extraordinary, is it not, in the fifth richest nation in the world, that we have people going to food banks on the scale that they are now. I feel strongly about that. I know lots of Conservatives who feel just as strongly about it as I do, and no doubt as Mr. Corbyn does. But because he has mentioned it, doesn't mean that we shouldn't take action against it. And there are a whole series of things like that where you can point out things that are wrong. But that is a pointless exercise unless you have a practical policy to correct them.
You talked of speaking up for the silent have-nots in the past. Now, some say that this new benefit system that's coming in, universal credit, that Ian Duncan Smith introduced when he was Secretary of State, is going to make families £2,400 a year worse off because the government's not giving it the funding. Half of all single parents, two-thirds of couples with children. Is that the sort of injustice that you see and want to speak out about?
I spoke out about that last year, in fact. The theory of universal credit is impeccable, and it is entirely logical. But in order to introduce something like a universal credit, you need to look at those people who in the short term are going to lose and protect them, or you will run into the sort of problems that the Conservative Party ran into with the poll tax in the late 1980s. So the principle has a great deal to commend it, but it isn't workable if there aren't the resources to introduce it properly. And to find someone on a very low income suddenly losing £2,400 a year is a substantial amount. And the argument that it's to encourage people to get into work isn't an argument that runs, to me, on something of that sort. So I don't oppose the principle of universal credit. I think there is a real danger that it will be introduced too soon and in the wrong circumstances. So I do think that we need to look very carefully at how it is introduced and when it is introduced and what the circumstances are and the resources are available to assist its introduction.
When you compare it with the reaction to the poll tax, it's one of the reasons you became Prime Minister, one of the reasons that Margaret Thatcher was thrown out of office. That was not just trouble in the streets, that was riots, serious violence. Are you saying that get this wrong and something similar could happen?
Well, we're not a nation that riots very often. I mean, if you go back to the 1840s, the world was having revolutions and riots, and the British didn't. They went on playing cricket with the local squire, and all remained much more clement than anybody in Europe imagined it possibly could. So we're not a nation that riots. I'm not predicting that. I am saying that if you have people who face that degree of loss, that is not something that the majority of the British population would think of as fair. And if people think you have removed yourself from fairness, then you are in deep political trouble.
What's so interesting about these themes is that some would say they are the basis of why Brexit was voted for in the first place. You recently travelled to the North East, to South Shields, with David Miliband, former Labour Foreign Secretary, of course. And you reflected not just on Brexit, which I promise you we're coming to in a second, but also some of your time in office and what you called your biggest single misjudgment, the closure of the pits, 31 pits that were closed in your time in office. Without going back over every part of that decision, do you look back at some of those aspects of deindustrialisation, as it became known, and think that's where the anger began? That is part of the roots, if you like, of Brexit in those communities.
Well, of course, the roots predated the mine closures in the 1990s by a very long time. They went right back to the 1970s and the industrial problems are there. So I think it's a little more complex than that. But certainly things like that are responsible for making the Conservative Party an unelectable party in some parts of the country. And it isn't attractive if the Conservative Party is unelectable in some parts of the country and the Labour Party is equally unelectable in another part of the country. That is very divisive. That isn't good for politics at all. Now, you mentioned my going to South Shields when we talked about the mine closures, and I take total responsibility for that. We weren't intending to be vicious or monstrous or any of these things. We had perfectly good plans, and we actually misjudged the fact that people were ready for the mines closures because the deep mining was coming to a close. And we just misjudged it. It was the middle of a recession, and we just plainly got it wrong. It was as simple as that. If I had left Downing Street and gone out to talk to the National Coal Board and to the mining union, as in retrospect I wish I had, I might have reached a different conclusion. So I blame no one for myself but myself about that. But the point, getting back to where you started about civility in politics, I went to South Shields, the one constituency in the country that has never returned a Conservative Member of Parliament since the Great Reform Act, and I couldn't have been more pleasantly received. We discussed the mines and all sorts of other things, but it was an extremely enjoyable occasion and one I wouldn't have missed.
Let's go to the main thrust of what you were talking about with David Miliband in South Shields, Brexit. You say you're surprised by how strongly you feel about this. And for many years, I've read little interviews you've given saying, I'm not going back into politics, you know. This is not for me. Why do you think you feel as strongly as you do about it?
Well, I'm out of politics now. It's a long time since I was in politics, as some of the Brexiteers are so happy to tell me. I'm a beaten-up old has-been. I concede that I'm old. Perhaps I'm beaten up. There's no doubt whatever that I'm a has-been. But I can't hide the fact that I think we have made a colossal error of judgment in deciding to leave the European Union, and that that error of judgment is a very long-term one that will affect not just this generation. I'm not predicting Armageddon the day we leave. Not just this generation, but subsequent generations. I think it is wrong on almost every count. If I may set out one or two things that people don't normally say about it. For a very long time, the United Kingdom has been in a very favourable position that they have two huge allies, the United States on one side and the European Union on the other. It is clear, particularly under President Trump, that the United States are moving away from Europe and away from us and towards the East. That didn't begin with President Trump, but it is accelerating under President Trump. So at the moment we lose one of the bulwarks that have been so supportive to us, we choose to leave the other, the European Union. So instead of having British influence magnified by our relationship with Europe and our relationship with the United States, we are suddenly not going to be tied significantly to these two great economic giants, but we are going to be 65 million Britons left entirely on our own. Now, I think that is a strategic error in terms of advancing our foreign policy interests, our defence interests, and much else as well.
But you see, there'll be people listening, won't there, who say, that's over, that argument. You had your chance. You spoke. Tony Blair spoke. David Cameron as Prime Minister spoke. There was a record turnout. There was a decisive margin. The people have spoken. There has, to coin a new phrase, there has been a people's vote and you lost it.
Well, we did. But what is going to be delivered as the Brexit outcome is going to bear no relationship to what the people were told would happen at the referendum. We were going to have a trade deal with Europe that was going to be the easiest in human history, or words to that effect. We were going to have masses of extra money for the National Health Service. A whole range of promises were made that we can now see were fantasy. The fact of the matter is that the referendum was won on a false prospectus and on the race card. That is how the referendum was won.
Race, not immigration.
Well, I think there's always a subliminal feeling when people talk about immigration. I mean, there was the suggestion that we were going to get 70 million Turks coming to the United Kingdom. Well, that was never likely, not least because Turkey would have been empty had that actually happened. Now, that was never going to happen. I wonder how that actually came about, that particular thought. And so all of the things that people thought they were voting for in that referendum are not going to be delivered. Now, that referendum was an advisory referendum. It was perfectly clear that it was an advisory referendum to advise Parliament and advise the government. It didn't bind Parliament and it didn't bind the government. And so the argument for a second vote really rests upon the point that if it was right to have an advisory referendum, surely it would be right to have a binding referendum once the facts of how we leave Europe are known and we can draw clear-cut conclusions as to what that will mean for people. Now, my concern about this is not about Europe per se. It's because I believe, and I believe it passionately, that an awful lot of people are going to be hurt on any sort of deal that we look likely to get at the present time. And the people who are going to be hurt most are the people who have least. You began by talking about a country at ease with itself. No country is going to be at ease with itself if the people at the bottom of the heap are hurt most by what we are about to do. Now, the Brexiteers feel very strongly about it, and I understand that, because I do too. But what I do feel is that we have to look much more carefully than we have done at what the practical reality is. Now, the Brexiteers close that out. Anyone who offers advice is condemned as the elite. Anything that is unfavourable is just thrown aside. This is just Project Fear. But the number of people in business, the number of people who are actually setting out the downsides to what will happen when we leave Europe is mounting on a daily basis. And you cannot ignore that. And the British public need to have a chance to absorb that and consider it.
You will know what people will say in reply. You may be the boy from Brixton, but you're the former Prime Minister who spends his life travelling the world and going first class and staying in the best hotels and meeting presidents and the chairman and chief executives of banks and investment funds. And what they say is you've forgotten the people you came from who might say to you, we were told this was a one-off chance to vote. We were told that was it. Forget advisory versus binding. We were told this was our moment, and his side lost, and we voted the other way, and he should just respect that.
Well, I'm sure people will say that, and I'm sure a lot of people will believe that. But I referred earlier to practical conservatism. I'm looking at the practical application of what will happen if we crash out of Europe without the right deal.
Let me ask you a practical question on the referendum, then, if I may. William Hague, former party leader, of course, former Conservative leader, he argues against a second referendum on two grounds. One, that it would be seen as anti-democratic, tearing up a decision already taken. But secondly, he says there simply isn't the time. It would take months for a bill to pass through Parliament. You'd then have to give time for the campaign itself. That would require requesting from the EU an extension of the whole process while Britain made its mind up. How do you answer him?
I find it a rather odd argument, even from William, whom I like and respect very much. I find it an odd argument that it's anti-democratic to ask the people. I think that I find that quite hard to swallow. And then we are looking at a change that is going to affect us, perhaps for good, perhaps for a very long time. Would we get an extension from the European Union if we ask for it? I have not a shadow of doubt that we would. And should we rush ahead if we think something is going to go badly wrong and our own citizens are going to be hurt? You said that perhaps I had lost touch with the people at the bottom because I spend my time with castles and kings. Well, I didn't notice a lot of castles at kings at South Shields. I don't expect a lot of castles at kings in the wilds of Norfolk, which is where I am tomorrow night, or in many other engagements that I have. I do try and make sure that I hear voices that don't come from what those might loosely call the elite.
Let's talk about how the Prime Minister handles this situation now. As someone who went through all this back in the early 90s, the rows about the Maastricht negotiation, do you have sympathy for her plight?
I do. I have great sympathy for her plight. And I think the way she is being treated by some of her colleagues is absolutely outrageous. It is perfectly proper for people to disagree with the Prime Minister's policy. I support the Prime Minister as Prime Minister, but I disagree with parts of her policy on Europe. I'm not a Member of Parliament, of course, but people in Parliament who are undermining the Prime Minister by wandering round saying, well, we're going to have 40-odd signatures for a leadership election tomorrow, and then saying, unless the Prime Minister does this thing or does that thing, we are going to vote against it. That's an intolerable way to treat a Prime Minister who is in the middle of negotiations, an intolerable way for parliamentarians. Now, let me make it clear. They are perfectly entitled to make their arguments against the Prime Minister's policy. I have no objection to that. But I think this subliminal threat, this not-so-subliminal bullying, you follow this particular route or we're going to oppose you, is simply not the way that I would have wished my colleagues in the House of Commons to behave.
No, you may not recall.
And every time I look at the alternatives to the Prime Minister, I become a stronger supporter of the Prime Minister.
Now, you may not recall a particular moment you were caught having a chat with someone a little like me, Michael Brunson, then political editor of ITN, in which you were describing your plight back in the 90s. You had a particular word to describe those in your cabinet and why you kept them there, even though they were disloyal, because of what they would do if they became what you called the dispossessed and the never possessed.
I did. That was an entirely private comment. I should never have made it. I apologise for making it, even though it was true.
They were bastards, as you call them.
But their behaviour was pretty intolerable, but not nearly as intolerable as the way the present Prime Minister is being treated. They did not refuse three times a day to acknowledge the Prime Minister's policy that they had agreed to in Cabinet. They did not do that. They may have been subliminally opponents of what I was doing, but they observed the civilities to a much greater extent than is happening at the present time.
You're not impressed, then, by seeing the International Development Secretary asked again and again and again whether she supports Chequers and refusing to do so?
Well, I'm not impressed, no. I mean, I didn't hear it, but I hear of it. I wasn't going to identify the person concerned, but you have done so. But I don't think she is probably the only person. So I think it is quite wrong that if people are sitting in Cabinet, they either support the government's policy or they don't sit in Cabinet. It's as simple and straightforward as that, as a pure matter of parliamentary history and straightforward personal honour.
Now, as it happens, when you use that word, which I understand why you don't want to repeat bastards, you were referring to people in the Cabinet and explain why you didn't kick them out. Now, Boris Johnson and David Davis have left the Cabinet. Not a bad description, that description you gave a few quarter of a century ago, is it? For their behaviour since?
Well, they must answer for their own behaviour. I just think they're absolutely wrong, both in what they say, though I no doubt at least one of them believes it, and in the way they're saying it. I think there is a way to oppose, and I think the mark has been overstepped on a number of occasions. And I don't think that is helpful. And I don't think that is helpful to the Tory party generally, because we suffered a dramatic defeat in 1997. And I think there were a number of reasons for that. One was that we had been there for 18 years and people were frankly fed up with the sight of the Tory party in government for so long. But also we made it much easier for people to vote against us because of the divisions that sort of ill discipline in Parliament opened up. I think the view of the electorate was, if they can't agree among themselves, why should we support them and put them back in government? And I find it very hard to disagree with the judgment that they made on that.
The tactics you chose all those years ago were to put your own future, to put the party's future in government on the line. So you lost a vote on Maastricht, and then you called a vote of confidence in you and the government. In the end, is that what this Prime Minister may have to do, to call the bluff of her Tory critics?
I'm not sure that I would particularly recommend that. I mean, that worked for a short while, but it was only a short while.
Got you the vote?
Oh, it did, yes. Yes, well, I was blessed in my opponents. It did get me the vote. That is certainly true.
Many of them the same opponents?
Many of the same people are still around. That is true. But they have been greatly added to by people who came in 1992. People forget about European policy. The Maastricht Treaty, when I came back from the negotiations in 1991, was hailed as a triumph. We had a massive majority for the deal I reached in the House of Commons, 500-odd to a small number. And then we had the 1992 election, and the personnel of the Conservative Party changed, and in came a lot of people who were ideologues and who were opposed to Europe. And we ran into trouble with a bill that had had massive support before in the House of Commons. And the other point about it was this, because I was often asked why I didn't have a referendum on it. And the reason I was so opposed to that was before I went to Maastricht, I had a debate in the House of Commons and I set out in detail what my negotiating objectives were, and Parliament approved of them. And I went to Maastricht, and I achieved my negotiating objectives. And so I went back to Parliament, having achieved what Parliament had approved they wished me to achieve. So I saw no reason in those circumstances to go further.
I don't want to intrude on private grief unnecessarily. There was a certain Rees-Mogg caused you one or two problems in your day when you were dealing with Maastricht. He took, not Jacob, of course, but his father, William Rees-Mogg, launched a judicial review into the bill. Do you recall what you said when you won that judicial review?
I think I know what you mean, but I didn't say it. I wrote it on a piece of paper, and I'm sure you have the quote.
A full gloat is merited.
A full gloat is merited. That is perfectly true. No, I wrote that on the note I had from my private secretary when all of Lord Rees-Mogg's arguments were thrown out of court as being inappropriate and not applicable.
If Theresa May can see off Jacob Rees-Mogg, will a full gloat be merited?
Well, let me talk about that for a moment, rather more seriously than perhaps you may imagine. The Brexiteers have every right to their views. I don't wish to suggest that they don't. But what does worry me about the European Research Group is that they are beginning to show all the characteristics of a party within a party. They have their own members, their own meetings, their own whips. I believe they have their own funding, and they have their own research. Admittedly, that research does not seem to have delivered anything worthwhile yet, but they have their own research. Those are the characteristics of a party within a party. Now, once you start that happening within a wider political party, you are in a very difficult situation indeed. And I think many of the people who are probably in the European research groups are possibly quite inexperienced members of Parliament, and they haven't quite seen it in that light. I hope they will look at it in that light, because it is very damaging. And it is, of course, used by the Conservative Party's opponents to show how divided we are. And that is very damaging and would be very damaging at a future general election.
Given that, I come back to Theresa May's tactics in dealing with this. Would it be perfectly legitimate in your mind to say, given that, if she can get a deal in the EU, it's perfectly legitimate then to get that deal through Parliament without the backing of all Conservatives in Parliament, but with the support of opposition members of Parliament?
Oh, I think that would be perfectly acceptable. I mean, I went further some time ago. Let me put this the other way round. I believe there is every chance that Brexit will go very badly for us over the next few years. I can't be certain, no one can, but I believe there will be a very considerable amount of hardship and difficulty both for the business community and for individuals as a result of Brexit. It's why I oppose it. Since that is so, if it does go wrong, the party that introduced it is going to bear the odium of Brexit. The nature of it has tied it almost inextricably to the Conservative Party. If I believe that, as I do, I think it would be quite a wise proposition for the Prime Minister to say, we have negotiated a Brexit. We had a referendum. We have negotiated on the basis of the referendum. This is our outcome. And put it to the House of Commons on a free vote. I think she might get a surprising amount of support for that proposition.
So by liberating her own supporters...
I don't for one moment think she is going to do that, yeah. But I think it is...
I wonder what your whips would have said if you'd suggested it.
Oh, but the whips would be opposed to it. The whips are always opposed to it.
But it's an interesting question...
You can be certain of two things in politics. The Treasury will oppose expenditure and the whips will oppose free votes. Those two things are written in the stars.
You raise the prospect for the party, for the Conservative Party, which is, of course, not your main concern. You're worried about the country. But Tony Blair was on this podcast recently, and he reflected that he wondered whether he could ever, or people of his views, could ever win back his party. Do you worry that it may not be possible for people like you to win back the Conservative Party?
No, I don't. And I'll tell you why not. Inside the Conservative Party, as yet unknown to the public at large, a very large number of extremely able young men and women who came in the last two general elections. Some of them are still on the back benches. Some are parliamentary secretaries. Some are in the whip's office. Some are ministers of state. They are very able. They have a lot of experience. Within a measurable period of years, they will have moved up from where they are to the cabinet. And I think that that will set the Conservative Party back on the route to being the pragmatic internationalist party that I joined a very long time ago. So I don't despair of that. There are a lot of able people in the middle of the Labour Party too, and that is very good for Parliament.
So the temptation of a new centre party, bringing together the people who agree on Brexit, bringing together people like you and David Miliband, who were together in South Shields recently, why doesn't that appeal?
Well, I can see why that appeals at this moment. Of course I can see why that appeals. The reason I draw back from it is that I think what happens if you have a centre party of moderates of all parties who are in government? They will no doubt do very well for a while, but all governments are mortal. And if a centre party bringing in people from the centre-right and the centre-left in one party were to govern for a few years and then become unpopular, as all governments do, and lose, who would be the opponents who would win? The very far right or the very far left? So that is the danger. If you have the centre of the Conservative Party and the centre of the Labour Party combining in a single party, you destroy the balance in the British political system. So my preference infinitely is to restore a greater degree of moderation. I'll rephrase it. Much less ideology to both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party.
Final question. If I could take you back to that soapbox in your teens in Brixton, and I showed you what politics looks like now, I showed you what the Conservative Party looks like now, do you think you would have taken a different decision about going into politics?
No, I don't. I mean, I was inspired by one particular politician, Ian MacLeod, whom you may remember, though many others may not. But he was an inspirational figure. He spoke of hope, which is the single missing ingredient in politics at the present time. Hope. Once that is back, the whole political scene will begin to change, and that means growth. We need growth, we need hope, and all will change, and more rapidly, I think, than most people imagine. And he spoke of hope, and he spoke of service, and he spoke of responsibility, and he spoke of people who were in a position to help, having an obligation to help others. He was a great Conservative orator, and I would probably have been a natural Conservative in any event. But having heard Ian MacLeod, there was never a shadow of doubt in my mind that that was the party where I would wish to be. And although the party has had its ups and downs, that is in the nature of politics, and the whole history of the Conservative Party has shown that, I wouldn't change. And I would still be in the Conservative Party, seeking to obtain that moderate centre-right party that I joined so long ago.
Sir John Major, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
You can feel John Major's pain. You can feel his anger when you talk to him. Now, in part, of course, that's the legacy of the battles of 25 years ago, battles that he still blames for destroying his government and delivering a landslide victory to Tony Blair. But it is also because he believes that the British people were lied to and that the people who will suffer as a result of Brexit are the people he came into politics to represent. Intriguing, too, to hear his criticism of the Tories' failure to address the agenda that Jeremy Corbyn has identified and his warning that if they don't, they face electoral annihilation. That's all from the Political Thinking podcast this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed it, please rate or review it on your normal podcast provider. The editor is Martin Rosenbaum. The producer is Peter Snowden. The studio managers, Annie Gardner and Jed Sudlow. Thanks for listening.
This is the BBC.
If I told you you're surrounded by a kind of hidden wiring, a system so complete it affects almost everything you do, what would you think? Well, you are. It's called capitalism, and it's all around you. This is Capitalism is a new podcast which tries to understand the economic and financial framework we've built around ourselves, a framework made up of markets, money, data, and some very big ideas. Discover This is Capitalism wherever you find your podcasts.